Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. With me today is someone that I met what seems like a lifetime ago. And I want to before I bring him on, I want to share something that I talk about in a lot of other settings, briefly, because it's just so relevant to me personally, and I think that there might be something in this for you. I feel like I had a big breakthrough a little while after I had a dot-com company. We raised over $80 million. Then we went out of business in the dot-com crash. I almost died of an autoimmune disease. Long story short, I got some really fabulous coaching from a very, very wise woman. And she said, John, live in the listening of the people who love you, because who you are is not who you think you are. Who you are is who they think you are, because that's how you show up in the world. And the first time that I went to TED, to the TED Active Conference, I met some people that are still just some of my dearest friends. And I got the experience of hanging out with people that I was convinced were about 10,000 times cooler than I was, who thought that I was special too. And it almost makes me cry to think about the difference that that made for me in my life. And Sebastian Wernicke, multiple time TED speaker, absolute one of the coolest dudes on earth, one of the funniest people I know, one of the most brilliant people I know, is one of those core people. And he's with me today. Sebastian, welcome.
Well, thanks, John. And what am I supposed to say now? It's almost impossible to follow that. So thank you for all those kind words. Wow.
Well, you're super welcome, and it's from the heart. And I wonder if you had a similar experience to me, because Sebastian and I met at a thing called TED Active. And I usually just say I went to TED because it's like, it's too hard to
nobody explain. Understands it anymore. No.
Yeah. Like, but there was this thing called TED Active, which was kind of like the kids' table for TED. And it was less expensive to get in. People were a lot younger. It was run by TED. It was the TED conference. It was a piece of the TED conference too. But I think what was different is that my experience, Sebastian, was that I walked in pretty sure that it was a clerical error that I somehow got in, because you had to apply, right? And I think everybody felt like
that. I think we all did. Yes, that was I was about to say that. Yeah.
So totally. We all thought the other people were cooler than us. So nobody showed up as the clearly coolest kid in school. Everybody thought everybody else was cooler. And it just made such a nice vibe.
It made it so special. And I think that's something that was like that in the first 1 or 2 years where they held that. And it sort of never came back after that. It was still awesome experience, but that was special. I think it was all these people from around the world, and they had just been watching TED Talks for a couple of years online and then said, oh, I want to meet other people who know this thing, because hardly anybody knew it at the time. It wasn't this.
Can you remember that?
It's a media company now, right? And it just used to be a conference. And like everybody was like, I discovered this special thing and I'm happy that I got in. Yeah. Oh, this is going to be so great. Let's go into the desert and Palm Springs. And
oh my gosh. The Riviera Hotel, you know, and that hotel was one of the most well-designed conference centers I have ever been to, because it had all those cool little hot tubs here and there, and you could wander around, but you could still see people, and it was all kind of central around the big pool. That was just a brilliant experience.
Yeah, and sort of this in-between thing, I think, it was quite modern in terms of a conference center and all the architecture thing. At the same time, it still had a bit of that 50s touch, you know, when like Frank Sinatra and all of these other people used to hang out in Palm Springs. And it just managed to combine that in such a beautiful way. It's really amazing.
And that was definitely the thing. Like, it felt very 60s hip, you know? It was so fun. Well, and you know, one of the big things that I remember about you, Sebastian, is that you were instantly elevated to one of the coolest kids around when we all heard your Buffalo talk, which was so absolutely awesome and classic. Will you tell us about your litany of TED Talks and kind of what that ride was like for you, starting
my
with
litany
Buffalo
of TED Talks? I love that. Well, so the whole thing started out, obviously, like you, you know, I thought, so I had gotten this hint from my, actually my PhD advisor, who I'm thankful to this day that he told me that. He told me there's one rule, Sebastian: you never go to a conference and don't talk. Like, go up there, go on the stage and talk, because otherwise, he knew me. So he was like, you're an introvert.
That's a great piece of advice.
Well,
yeah.
You go up on the stage and you talk, because otherwise people will approach you and you don't have to approach people. So that's going to be nice for you. So,
yeah.
And of course, you know, having watched all of these talks, they were like 400, right? And I was just like, okay, what am I going to talk about? What can I do? And my wife is a linguist. And so there's some language thing there. And English is probably the only language where you can form sentences using just a single word. And that word turns out to be buffalo. And so buffalo is like these three things, right? So it's the city, it's the animal, obviously, and it's also a verb. Not many people know it, but it's like, you know, to bully or to intimidate, I think is what it means.
Buffalo someone.
Yeah, to buffalo someone. Yeah, and so you can just say buffalo as often as you want, and it's always a correct English sentence. just found that amazing.
It takes a German to figure that out.
No. It's actually a professor from Buffalo. Well, it's not clear who figured it out, but there is a professor from Buffalo. There's one story where they say, okay, he figured it out.
Uh-huh. It's pretty funny.
I just use it. You know, I like the Germans do, I took this invention, you know, and then furthered it, basically.
Yes. Is it available? People can go find it?
I think you can go find it, but it's like not like like there's now this whole, you know, hierarchy of things that they publish that they don't publish. I know, you know, that tells you something of what happened since then. You remember we still got a set of DVDs with the recordings from that very first conference that was mailed to you.
Yes, I do remember that. Yeah.
So I have it on DVD, and if anybody's interested, I'll be happy to take a copy of the DVD.
Okay, it's fabulous. It's something that we just got to get. I mean, we should talk after this and figure out if there's a way to put it private link or whatever. I'll link it from the show notes. It's absolutely screamingly funny. So your wife said,
we were in conversation. Yeah, she's a linguist. And then it was just like, okay, what's a funny thing I can talk about? And they also told you, of course, okay, make it brief, right? So you got to be like, this is TED. And you know, you have the clock running in front of you. So you got to be fast. And so Kelly, who's the, for everybody listening, the curator organizer, you know, I emailed her and said, I can do it in 1 minute. Because I thought if I was like super brief, they would let me get in, like on the stage.
Brilliant. Like
And she was like, well, I suggest you take 3 minutes for this whole thing, which I did.
That's
and
awesome.
So, yeah. And I thought, you know, it's just one word. I can do it in 1 minute. So that also sort of fit the whole pattern. And then, as anybody knows who's done these sort of talks, then it was days and weeks of putting the whole thing together. It's insane. Yeah.
Sebastian, I don't know if you know this, but it's something that I talk about a lot, is something that I learned from a really dear friend of mine who was friends with Steve Jobs and worked with Steve Jobs. His company got acquired early on, and he was in the inner sanctum there working on those great speeches with Steve and everything. Did you know that after they created the speech, Steve Jobs would practice for an hour for every minute he was going to be on stage? 45 hours of practicing a 45-minute speech.
Wow. But I can completely relate to those numbers. When basically I look at myself, how much time does it take to prepare one of these TED Talks? Or also ask anybody else. I think for every minute of TED Talk, you put in like 10 hours.
Yeah.
That's, I think, roughly, you know, the amount you need.
That's
to
a
get
pretty
it done,
good ratio, actually. Yeah. I had never broken it out like that, but I think that's if you look, and that's why you shouldn't complain if they give you a 10-minute talk instead of an 18-minute talk.
18 minutes is tough, and you got to have the whole rhythm thing. And because it's not like, you know, the usual thing where they say, well, if they let you talk for longer, it's going to be easier to put together. No, it's always going to be hard. And the 18 minutes to sustain that and have like awesome stuff.
Like 45 minutes, that's easy. Okay, we got that. But anything anytime, within the TED framework, 18 minutes or less, anything in that is going to be tough.
Yeah. I mean, the 3 to 6 minutes, you know, you just have to have one idea and then you can really craft it and put it out there. But it's like an like a commercial or something like that. You know, you have this one idea, you build up to it, there's the whole climax thing, and then you're done. And and with 18, you know, you got to have, oh, here's another awesome thing. And by the way, if you thought this was awesome, I have something even more. And then unless you work, I don't know, unless you work into quantum gravity, whatever, like how are you going to do that? It's like,
That's a really good point. That's a really good point, because I think sometimes people get the mistaken impression that the more the organizers like them, the more time they get, which just is not true.
No, you know? No. Everybody gets a very carefully allotted time slot, and then they have the blinking clock in front of you. You know, that's always ticking, always ticking. And then the red light starts flashing even shortly before. Oh, man.
And I don't know if you remember, and I won't say who, but I've been there when Chris Anderson had to pull someone off stage.
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing. That's embarrassing. That's not what.
But they should all know by now. I mean,
oh, they should know. That's why it's kind of extra embarrassing for the person who got pulled off stage. They should know, you know.
And this is one of the nice things, but don't you miss that at other conferences? Like when the time runs out. So awesome, right? It's just like,
yes.
I don't care who you are or who you and I mean, this is one of the things I mean, we've both been going to a lot of these conferences, right? And it just ruins you for all of these other conferences where you're the speaker hasn't practiced, you know, they or what the one thing I really really always see is like, especially with scientific speakers, unfortunately, you know, they start up their huge PowerPoint with like the 300 slides. Then they ask the organizer, how much time do I have? And depending on that, you can sort of feel them in their mind, right? Basically calculating, okay, I got 40 minutes. Maybe I can wrangle like 5 extra. Oh, I'm going to get to slide 60. That's cool. You know?
Yeah, right.
What is that? Oh,
dude. You know, it does ruin other conferences. And, you know, I kind of think that if I ever do a conference, I'm thinking right now, I'm probably going to have a water balloon launcher. And like, if when the red light starts flashing, you have like 30 seconds before the water balloon gets launched, you know? But you just brought up something that I wanted to talk about that first talk, Buffalo, Buffalo. Your incredible PowerPoint deck. Will you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think there's a lesson to be learned for anybody that wants to really knock it out of the park.
Yeah, that PowerPoint deck was so funny because afterward, everybody asked me what kind of PowerPoint tools had I used to create that. And actually, the tool that I used, so I have to describe it a bit. It's like a paper style background, and then there were like these little pictures appearing on it, and pins, and you know that sort of pointed things out. And everybody asked me, okay, what's the tool? What's the rendering? And I was like, no. This is actually a piece of paper where I then put onto like little photos, little pins, and it was all physically done. And with a camera from the top, I just made photographs, and that was my slide deck.
And it was fabulous. It was so
well. Thank you.
Good. Yes, it was really good. You're an artist, that's for sure. So
it was fun to put together. Also, like I think it's faster than real PowerPoint. Like once some of the talks I did after were PowerPoint, and you can just, you know, you tweak a little here, a little there, and it's so difficult to make look good because, of course, initially it's all this clinical white and even if you have color, right? It's all clean. It's clean boxes, and I think just as a human, you're used to having all of these little details. And of course, when you do it physically, right, it has these shadows and sometimes it's a bit shaky, but that's okay too. And all of these things.
It's kind of Star Wars. Like that's, I think, what one thing that was so great about Star Wars when it first came out was like dirty outer space. What are you talking about? It's not clinically white and clean.
Like in the second movie, you know, these I don't know what, like these Tauntauns, I think is what they're called, right? Where they're running around on this ice planet. And the handmaids ones. They look so much better. It just has this
yes
physicalness, this realness to it. And also like the space battles, you know, where they still have the photo, like they shot it really on camera and it's not a computer. You can tell. You can really tell. And I think that's more physical PowerPoint, I guess.
Yeah, I think we're making a good argument for it here.
It's just really hard. I mean, you have to print out every single piece of text that you want and then just cut it out with a scissors, put it on the... I didn't have kids then. You can obviously tell, right?
Right. That's it changes things.
Yeah.
Well, and Sebastian, though, I think the great thing about that is the thing that... That's sort of the problem with PowerPoint is it makes it too easy to just cram so much stuff in. Like you had to think about it. Like, do I care enough to print this out and cut it out and tape it up and take a picture?
Yeah.
And if you do, great. Then it probably is going to work. But, you know, like that kind of was a good limiting factor.
Yeah. And the other thing, it forces you to do also, it's kind of funny. I never thought about this, but there's a lot of movie analogy here because it also forces you to create a storyboard up front. Because you can't immediately just sit there and like, oh, I'm going to write this, I'm going to move that around. No, you need to plan it out. So you first have all these post-its with like, okay, this is going to be my message here. This is what I'm going to do there. And you really plan it out carefully because you also know, and I think that's a really good factor, once you have the whole camera set up, you're just doing this once, right? This is an afternoon where you're going to take the photos. Those are going to be your slides. You're never going to do that again. You're not going to be able to retouch it in any sensible way. Like there's production here, right?
Yes, that's so great. You know, it's good to hear you say that because this is what I think. I'm holding up some sticky notes.
Oh,
I think this is some of the best technology ever for creating great talks. And that's exactly what I suggest people do is write one idea, one thought, one story, one point.
Absolutely.
Yellow sticky, put them all over the wall, then curate the best stuff of that to another wall, and then start to put it in order. Storyboard.
That's how I create every important talk to this day. It's like yellow sticky notes. You put on there, what's the message? And maybe if you have an idea for an image or something like that, and you just crazy arrange it around the desk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Perfect. That's awesome. Well, and then after Buffalo, then came the TED Talk analysis talk.
So it was a really cool experience because, you know, as you said, you know, I gave this talk on the Buffalo and I thought, oh, that's cool. It's actually, you know, after that, it was so easy to make connections. So I want to do this again. I want to give another talk like that. And and also the whole experience is just so awesome being on that stage and it's like no other conference, like complete attention.
Yes.
So an incredible speaking experience. So I said, okay, I want to do this again, but how am I going to do that? And then I thought, well, they just published not only the video talks, but they also published the transcripts of those. Yeah. And so I know how to analyze data. So that's something I know how to do. And so I thought, well, I can just analyze the data of all of the past talks. And it started out with a crazy idea because I thought, well, if I analyze all that data, I'm just going to figure out what the best talk ever is going to be. And I'm just going to give that. Right. So it was the idea. I'm going to use data to create the ultimate talk.
I love it.
As a complete element of insanity to it, obviously. But maybe that's why. So I figure out, well, this is going to be a lot of work to analyze the data. So again, I wrote to Kelly and I basically said, okay, I have this idea. I want to run past you because this is probably going to be a lot of work to actually do. So I kind of want to know, you know, can I get on stage with that or not? And she liked the idea. And so in the end, what I did is I downloaded like the transcripts of 500 TED Talks, I think. And then just, the really cool thing is they had created, I don't think they wanted to, or it was intentional, but they had created one of the most awesome data sets actually, because you had the videos, you had the transcripts, but they also had a super fine grade rating system for the talks. They don't have that anymore. They somehow switched that off. But you know, today, like you only get the thumbs up, thumbs down. And it used to be much more specific than that. So you could give like, I think it was
this was inspiring. This was really smart. This had good data. This, right?
You had like 14 different ratings. You could say this is persuasive, fascinating, but you could also say like the bad stuff. This is obnoxious. This is confusing. This is long-winded. And so you had this super rich data set and you basically couldn't download it directly. So you had to, you know, use some computer science skills to scrape the website and get the transcripts down there, get the ratings from somewhere else. And so all of this got put together. And then, of course, I figured out, okay, this is never going to lead to the best TED Talk. Technology is just not that far. I'm going to completely blame this on technology, of course. Yeah. But I could still talk about, you know, what makes a great TED Talk and what makes a bad TED Talk. And so this turned into a 6-minute presentation, essentially, where I could just say, okay, here's the statistical characteristics of the ultimate TED Talk and the statistical, you know, whatever makes a bad TED Talk.
So what do you remember from those statistics, just for people that would like
The most important one was, if you cite the New York Times, you're done for. Like, you cannot cite the New York Times. Yeah, that's absolutely...
That was probably an early predictor. I think that's... We probably should have paid more attention.
Well,
if you need
to rely on external sources, you know, that's already something like that. You know?
That's pretty funny.
You should wear glasses. I also did like this analysis of how people were dressed. And if they were like slightly dressed up, that was also a good thing. Like don't do the suit thing. Yeah. But also don't do the whole t-shirt and shorts, something in between. Yeah. And that's really going to get you there. And then of course it got crazy. You know, I went into analyzing the colors of the videos and trying to figure out, you know, what makes the, and then of course there was like this weird shade of pink that came up that made for a very persuasive talk. And then I found this video frame of Hans Rosling, you know, the other guy who used to do all these data talks, wearing a shirt that had like this red, white checker pattern that actually mixed up to exactly that weird pink color. And he was standing in front of a pinkish background. And so I was just like, okay, this is, and of course he's very convincing, right?
Yes. Oh, he's fabulous.
On the money. Yeah.
That's so funny. It was so funny. And I think, yeah, there was a blue color that I think I might have lifted and used for something.
Well, and of course, it's. I mean, some people actually thought I was doing it more seriously than I actually was. So I got lots of emails and questions afterward about people. So is it really this blue shade? Should I do it a little bit different? I was just like, I was trying to make some point about cause and correlation here, which somehow probably didn't come across as perfectly, but okay, you know.
It's so funny. It's so funny. I think it also speaks to the kind of rabidness of how much people want to be asked to give a TED Talk, you know. right. Anything. Like, I'll do anything that makes it work and makes it better. I don't know if you remember my first one. I don't know if you were there. I wore a blue striped suit and I wore a tie, which you're not supposed to do at TED. And I just made every mistake in the book. Like, you did basically the exact opposite of what I did, and yours worked and mine definitely didn't. But it was an unbelievable learning experience for me. I was trying to make it seem like I had stepped out of a virtual world, because that's what I was excited about.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I will admit embarrassingly that I think I approached that first one too selfishly. And that just doesn't work at TED. It just doesn't work, you know?
It didn't used to. I think that's where I make a little distinction.
Okay, yeah, good point. That's
one of the beauties of this of you know how it was 10 years ago. I don't know. It's so weird saying that. But
get off my lawn.
No, but you know, everybody came there without an agenda, and I think this is not what it is anymore, right? So it wasn't about you're going to give this TED Talk to sell more of your book or sell more of yourself, and it starts. Yeah. It's going to be the start of your campaign or whatever. It's just okay. Here's something I have to share, and and I think, you know, we were all rolling the dice on this one. So, some things worked, some things didn't, but that was okay, because it wasn't this, oh, here's my big moment. And if I get this right, I'm going to be, I don't know, famous, sell something or not. No, it was just like, here's something to share. Okay. It works. Yeah. It doesn't matter. You know, you put everything into it, and that was the main point. Yeah. So you just try to create something for everybody else. Yeah. And some of these things are going to work out, some are not. But the beauty of it is everybody had that intention, and it feels a bit more pure. I don't know. It sounds weird saying that, but It does.
No, it certainly does. It certainly does. And it's something that I still remind people of, because I obviously get asked a lot about this. And you know, I think one of the things when it comes to just getting invited to speak at TED is, first of all, speaking on the main stage, which you've done, is like lightning striking.
Yes. For
the other thing that I think, though, is if you are out there doing something fabulous, create a TED-like talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
And go give that anywhere. You don't have to wait for TED. Go give that awesome 12-minute, 18-minute talk anywhere and just make a difference, you know? And who cares?
And I think that's what everybody's craving for, you know? And when people then say, okay, this whole TED thing has become a bit formulaic and sort of overproduced, I think that's exactly what people are getting at, right? Because you can't... Yeah. I mean, what many people don't know, I guess, it just used to be a conference where people got on stage and shared stuff. Okay, it used to be more famous people than myself, you know? But by association, I don't know. But no, but I think this is, you know, it was just about sharing some stuff. And now, of course, it's become a different thing. I think essentially it's a media company now, right? And and you look at all of the different things they have the podcast, they have the book business, they have, I looked it up, they have like 130,000 videos on the TEDx channel.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, Netflix, or they probably have even more, but it's insane. And
it's crazy. It's really wild.
But it's, I think there is a difference between sort of the old days and what it used to be and what it became. And the old thing was about, I think, what exactly you say, you know, you just give a talk. And if you don't give it there, you give it somewhere else, and you can just do the whole sharing thing. And if it's good, if it's authentic, and, you know, it's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great. And so, Sebastian, now you're working. So you went from biotech for a while. We ran around in Boston together and rode unicycles down a hallway, and there were probably
at 3 a.m. You know, at night.
Yep. It was, you know, we were both younger.
We were wild.
And now you've always been into data science, right?
Yeah.
And now you're at data science and artificial intelligence, and you're bringing that to, particularly to German industry.
German engineering and data science. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that. And then, you know, there's a pivot that I'd like to take from that. I'd love to talk about the going forward implications of the last year we just had. But let's start. Ooh. Let's start with data science for German engineering companies. Is that just super easy? Is that just an easy sell?
Well, it does fit some of the stereotypes. In a way, it's an easy sell because, of course, everybody has read the same trade publications right now. Oh, by the way, you're an English native speaker. You need to explain something to me. So I try to look up, you know, the whole data is the new oil thing, which I find it's wrong, and it's so old. But then I looked it up and typed into Google, like, data is the new, and it came up, data is the new bacon. Is that like a thing that you can say in English, this is the new bacon? What does it mean?
I mean, you can, and probably to fully, you know, it's really the new buffalo bacon is what I think. But you could Google, who is it? There's some comedian, it might be Gaffigan or something, and he does this thing about bacon, right?
Okay. And
so in America, you know, in certain circles, bacon is just the thing.
I can see that.
So
also for my but no, I just thought, you know, do they want to say too much data is unhealthy, or like what
is that what they're doing? I think that plays into the bacon debate, the healthy, not healthy part.
They just keep bacon. It at the tasty thing. Okay.
Yeah. Bacon.
Yeah. Sorry for the
But I think that you know, maybe you could wake people up a little bit. But, you know, I mean, even The Economist did an article about how data is the new oil, right? I mean, it's how they justified the stock price of Tesla, right?
Yeah, I mean, so everybody has realized it, including, you know, all of the clients here back in Germany. But the thing is that as a German engineering company, what you're used to is you're used to constantly making all of these tiny improvements. That's how you build a really good car. That's how you build a really good machine. You know, it's like, it's not this disruptive thing, but it's like, okay, every year we have like a million 1% improvement ideas, and we add them here, we add them here, we add them here. And there's a part of data that can also achieve that. But if you really, you know, say, I want to become a company that relies more on data to make decisions, to our products are going to become more data driven, or however you want to call it, that's a big transformative leap. And so it's an easy sell in the sense that everybody realizes, oh, this whole data thing is important. But then actually getting it to fit the mindset, that's always a journey you have to take, because of course it's like, okay, where can data make this little improvement, or data can make that little improvement, but that's not what it's about usually, right? You're trying to actually basically say, like I think the Tesla analogy fits very well, where you're saying, okay, a car is not just a piece of engineering that has a bit of computer inside of it. Actually, the software is like a huge percentage of how the car is perceived, and like what it does and what it's worth. And you can update your car by updating software. And I think that's an entirely new concept. Of course, you can transfer that to, you know, other industrial sectors here as well. But it's like, okay, I have this gearbox. So what's a digital gearbox? You know? What's that going to do? And so you got to explain it. And, take it step by step. So it's not like everybody is immediately getting it. Once they do, of course, it's a huge thing, but it's a joint journey you have to take.
Well, you know, I love hearing that. And it reminds me of one of the things that I try to remind people of a lot when I'm working with them in this kind of a setting is, yes, email travels at the speed of light, you know, and yes, data is disruptive and all that. However, at a very fundamental level, business still happens at the speed of human.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
We got to take that into account, and we might be able to speed that up a little bit or manage for that somehow. But if we ignore that, it's not going to work.
And it's funny that you say that, because I think there's an analogy to how you also craft a talk where you want to, you know, persuade people or bring them somewhere else. I think, I don't know where it comes from, but somebody once told me this image of, like, you know, in the cartoons, they have this 16-ton weight, you know, so you have this huge weight, and then you have like a tiny rubber band attached to it. And and the weight is like where people's mindset is, and you're trying to get it somewhere else, but you only have this tiny rubber band, which is sort of your talk, you know, so you got to pull very slowly and step by step, because otherwise it's just going to go bing and
snap
and it's gone, right?
Really great. That's a great analogy.
I wish I knew where it came from, but and I think this is the same with businesses and giving talks, you know, it's always you can't accelerate it, and you can't just, you know, make the leap. It's always moving step by step and into a clear direction. Or if it's not a clear direction, then it's going to take longer, but, you know.
That's really good, Sebastian. I love that. So given what you know, and given what you've been through, like everybody, I mean, let me sort of set a stage for this question. So one thing I think is true is that we have realized on some level that we are all in the same boat with what's just gone on over the past year, the coronavirus, the, you know, all of that stuff. We're in the same boat, but we're in the same storm, excuse me, but we are not in the same boat, you know. Globally, it's been a storm, and the experience that people have had is very different, and it's really opened up my eyes, and I think a lot of people's eyes, to the disparities and the differences, and, you know, look at the difference between all these boats in this same gigantic storm. I'm reading a book about post-coronavirus, and one of the most stunning, so one thing is that the amount that online alcohol sales are up in the United States, and the amount that online gun sales are up in the United States, and then the amount that riding the New York Transit is down, you know, like that stuff was pretty stark. But one of the things that really blew my mind, because I think it's such a great, it points the way towards what's going on so much, is over the last decade, e-commerce grew very steadily at a reliable 1% a year, 10% over the last decade. In the first 2 months of the pandemic, online grew, e-commerce grew by 10%. So a decade in 2 months, 8 weeks versus 10 years of growth. So, and you know, a lot of the consultants that I speak with that I'm supporting and things have been saying things like, you know, we've been accelerated into the future, like at least 5 years in the first month of the pandemic, you know, and we're not going back. What are some of the things from your perspective with, you know, your knowledge of data science and you're sitting right now in Munich in Germany? What are some of the things that just setup makes you think about?
Well, I don't know if people are happy now that the revolution is here, we can finally order toilet paper online or something. I think some of that acceleration has also been overplayed. Of course, you know, people are gonna order online. I mean, one of the things that clearly shows here, and I guess that's true everywhere, is that you have this sort of differentiation, right? So there's certain retail stores, for example, you know, that are small, owner operated, that actually are making it very well through this pandemic because, you know, they have like these owners that really know what they're doing. They're creative. They're putting out all of these new ideas. And then there's like the shop where you basically can just go and buy things, but you can also do that online, and that's going to go away. So you can really see how the whole, you know, in the end, what prevails, I think, is this creativity and this sort of sense of, you know, what's the new thing I have to do in order to get through this pandemic. And I mean, I think in a way it's, I like to think about, we were talking about this whole data disruption thing earlier, and I think it's a bit similar where, you know, you can either think of what data is doing in these like little steps and basically say, okay, where's the next 1 or 2% optimization that I can do, or where's really this, the step change. So one example we used to, I can talk about it. So we used to consult for a company that is doing these specialized machines. It's really fascinating. They build machines where you can like move atoms around. It's yeah, German engineering, okay. Obviously.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it's like, yeah. I mean, you know, it's
we're not
precise,
doing it. Any- yeah. And whenever like my son German asks, you know, what's the coldest temperature? And I tell him, you know, it's such and such. Oh, where is that? And I tell him, and this is a friend of mine. I tell him, well, in my friend's machines, that's, you know, so it's really good to have a friend that's operating at the coldest, almost close to absolute zero. Yeah.
you know, hey, in Germany, of course.
But so we were thinking with them together, you know, what's a good way to put this whole data and digitalization thing into your machines? And it's not immediately obvious because, you know, you're moving atoms around. So, you know, how are you going to help them? I have to tell one more story aside, and it may be a bit German. So the board of that company had said, okay, we're going to have this digitization initiative. Is it digitization or digitalization? Again, we're going to use this data thing, right? And so the way they did this is they created a handbook for becoming digital. So when I say handbook, I actually mean a physical handbook. So it was like 150 printed pages of here's how we want to become digital in the future.
That's pretty funny.
It that wasn't available as a funny. PDF. Is it really? No, you could just get the book. I think they were sort of worried about people copying it or anything.
Yeah, I
just
been
found
a
that
security,
so funny. Like,
but it's still
here's
funny.
Our digitization handbook. Yes, yes. I love that.
Thump.
But it had good content, you have to say that.
Well, that's good.
but then, you know, in the discussions, for example, it comes up with, well, why are you selling these machines? And it turns out, well, it's because researchers, they do really cutting edge stuff with that. Like you know, cover of science, cover of nature. So like these really high profile scientific magazines. And so, well, you probably can't add much data to the machine itself, but maybe you can use data to help the scientists publish their research. So you could have something like, I don't know, natural language processing to help them get faster from the data they collect to the paper that they want to write. Or you could use these technologies to network them with each other, right? So it's these sort of a bit of leap thinking of not just saying, okay, how can I just improve the little thing that is here? But what's my product really about? And maybe if I take a step back and look at, you know, what it is I'm trying to achieve, I can have this whole array of new technologies actually used. Yeah, I can help with paper writing. I can help with publishing. I can help with calibrating the machines. I don't know. There's lots of different things you can do. Similar to the whole car redefinition. Yeah, a car isn't just for getting you from A to B. It has all these really cool features. Like, actually, I think, you know, why Tesla is so successful, because they realize the car is for showing off.
Oh yeah, totally.
So you can just pay the money so I can accelerate faster. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you show your friends. There's no purpose other than telling your friends, look the cool thing I got. And you know, if you can transfer that to something like a piece of engineering that operates near absolute zero, that's where we need to be.
Yeah. There you go. Well, yeah. So bring in sexy to absolute zero.
Yeah, bring sexy to the science and to absolute zero and the atoms and all of that stuff.
That's pretty funny. That's true. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, the other thing that I think would be maybe missing is a little bit of virtue signaling. You know, if you could, you know, make it so that people could be right and make other people wrong with their choices here.
Well, I think
the gas guzzlers, you know.
Well, I'm not sure I want to bring more of that to the science. You know, you're wrong, because I think they have plenty of that going on there.
But. Yeah, yeah. No, it was a bad sarcastic idea. so you know, and you and I were talking about how we've both got young. You've got two young sons. I've got one. Yeah. And the past year we were not traveling, because both of us.
Yeah, that was one of the total upsides of not traveling, just to spend time with the kids.
Yep. And I think one of the things that I've been thinking about, Sebastian, and talking with people about, because I think it's a worthwhile conversation, I wonder what you think, is obviously there's been devastation, and there are massive downsides, and there are people who are just still just grieving and awful, awful, awful stuff. No doubt. And there have been some silver linings to these very dark clouds. And I think that there are things that I want to hang on to, and that I want to learn, and that I want to preserve in one way or another, to some degree or another, that I've learned out of this. And one of the things I'd like to do, I mean, I think I'm still going to end up traveling, and kind of think I want to. I mean, I love to be with people, right? Like when we jumped on this call initially, we were talking about how much
you need to come to Munich for sure. Yeah. Yes. Physically. There's no sense, you know, running around with my iPhone, showing you, you know, the closed down beer tents or whatever, you know, that doesn't make sense.
No. So I think we want to be in person, and I am going to try to bring more of the Zoom stuff to in between being in person. And maybe instead of getting together every quarter with clients, maybe I'll get together once a year for a little bit longer with clients, and then we'll, you know, work it out via Zoom the rest of the year. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's one of the silver linings, is just how much time I have not spent on planes and how much time I have not spent away from my family. I think we're particularly lucky that our kids are the ages they are, because, you know, being stuck at home with mom and dad was pretty fun for Johnny. Like, he wasn't like amped about it. He thought it was pretty great.
I think mine got tired at some point. It's like, okay, can't we see other kids? Like, does it always have to be you? But okay. You know?
Well, there is that for sure. So what are some of the other, are there other silver linings that you've noticed, or things you've been thinking about?
The one thing that I think we've become much more conscious about is, why are we traveling somewhere, right? And I think it all used to be mixed up in the sense of, oh, so I work in a client-based business, project-based, right? So it's basically a signaling. Yeah, I you're so important to me that I'm going to travel there and so on. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But then once we started working together, so us and the clients, I think it's become, or I'm hoping that it's become much more palatable to basically say, okay, we're going to visit you regularly, but then what are we going to do when we visit each other, right? So we are going to spend some time together. We're going to, you know, because if we're going to work together, we also need some social time. So travel, I think and hope is going to be for socializing. And then you do that in long intervals, but you don't need to travel every time. You're just trying to get work accomplished together.
Yeah.
And,
you know, yeah, that's really good.
And I think that's the same actually for us here. So I run a team of about 50 people by now. Yeah. And so before the whole Corona thing, we're a fast growing company. And before Corona, I was always saying to people, no, we're not going to allow this home office thing. Why? Because we're super fast growing. Yeah. And so we just need to all stick together. Otherwise we're going to have new people. We won't have team culture. It's going to be, people understood, but they hated it as well. And justifiably so. But I think also there's so many companies where we're sort of on the track where, you know, this whole, you can work from anywhere. I think it also has this notion of, well, you know, I can just plug in the humans when I need them and then I can plug them back out. And so, and now, as always, I think the truth is sort of in the middle where you can basically say, okay, we need to spend some time together, but then we're going to do it for socializing. We're going to spend a lot of time on the, you know, we're just going to hang out at the coffee machine or doing lunches and doing stuff like that. And then I don't care, you know, get your work done wherever you want and however fits you. Come into the office if you like that. Some people love that and some don't. That's fine. But this conscious decision of, this is why we're going to get together, because, you know, we need to spend some time together as humans, but then we're not going to waste that time with a stupid meeting. Then we're really going to spend time with each other and be present and all of these things. And then we go our ways and then we get some other work done that needs to get done. I really hope that this is going to be the way that we work in the future. This mix of, you know, people, but flexibility. You know,
Sebastian, I'm really thinking that my business is going to be pivoting to that more. And what I mean by that is I think that what we're going to see and what I've already started to see is not every business, right? But a lot of businesses are going to take some of their real estate spend.
Yeah.
And they're going to not spend it on real estate. And I'm telling people, I really think you need to save some of that money so that you can get together every 6 months with your team. Mm-hmm. And I've already read that, you know, resort destinations are starting to ramp plans up for this. Like instead of spending money on the office, right? We take that money and we go to someplace really freaking nice for like a long weekend or a week or whatever. And I think my training's going to be impacted by this, Sebastian. I'm already looking at how can I do things that will be really fun, really social, still have a lesson, make people better at what they do, connect them and slot into something like our week in Hawaii to
be
with each other, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is something that's just going to be happening a lot more.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, if you think about the crazy office prices in the US, I mean, Munich is expensive by German standards, but then I always tell people, you know, what office space costs in Boston. And they were like, wow, that's crazy expensive. And then I tell them, no, that's per square foot, not square meter. And there's like 10 of these in a square meter. It's like insane.
It's crazy. Well, I mean, and you know, I mean, my heart goes out in a way when I was listening to an interview with Andrew Yang, who's now running for mayor of New York, with Sam Harris, who's one of my favorite freaking heroes of all time. But those two were talking and I didn't lock the numbers in, but it's something like 68% vacancy in Midtown Manhattan right now.
Wow. Okay.
It's gnarly. I mean, And I don't think New York, and New York has the opportunity to roll with this and pivot, because destinations are still going to be something. It's just, maybe it's going to be something slightly different, you know?
Yeah. And you're going to have to find the balance with that. I think for us, running a team of data scientists, these data scientists, they have like these different working modes. And so, sometimes it's a lot of discussion, figuring out creatively, how do we solve a problem? You know, how do we do that? And then there's this quiet time you need in between where you have this deep work sort of thing, you know, where you, for 6 or 8 hours, just no interruption. What's the point of sitting everybody in a highly expensive space, putting on their headphones because they're so cramped together? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
No. Do you know Matt Mullenweg? He's the So I've been following him and reading his stuff and like the 5 levels of distributed autonomy for work or whatever. And, you know, I do think that it's very possible that a good number of companies being good at distributed work and being good at managing and holding that kind of a team together, there are a number of companies where that is going to be, I think, a deciding factor in who actually succeeds. You know,
yeah.
I think it's going to be not every company, no. But it's possible that a company like yours could outperform a company that was forced to be all in the same office space because of just that. You could let people create their days around what they were actually doing, and they could get these blocks of time. They could, maybe they work best at, like, you know, from the afternoon till late at night, and they want to sleep late and go for a walk before they start working. I mean, who knows, right? But people can craft their day that way.
Yeah. And I think we're going to have a mix of that. So at least that's how we're planning it. So we're going to keep the office space, and we've managed to get nice offices at a reasonable price, I would say.
Well, yeah, good time for that.
But so we're going to have something like where we say, okay, everybody is going to come in 2 days into the office. You want to come in more? That's fine. Two days is what you got, or something like that.
Yeah.
God, people in my team listening to this, on the podcast, you said it's just going to be two days.
Yeah.
Nothing's been decided, but it has not been decided. Yes. But I think we, the other thing is, though, that we found is the fact that we really spent a lot of time in a single space before this whole corona pandemic happened. It really helped us get through it, because, you know, we still had this sort of team cohesion once we were in different locations and people looking out for each other. So it does help to make it more than just this whole, so I'm not for, you know, everybody at work needs to be friends, but, you know, when you spend a lot of time together, it does happen. Yeah. And it's a good thing. Yeah. And I think this is just about physically being together. There's something about this whole having a screen in between. If that's all you ever have, I don't believe in that. I think it's some mix, I guess, is gonna, and it's also nice, of course, if you know that the people you're working with are, well, not exactly in the same location, but they're reachable, you know, and you can also just say, okay, let's drive down somewhere where we're both close and have a coffee with masks on or whatever, you know, we're allowed to have right now these days.
Yeah. 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 I think that it's going to be an interesting ride. That's for sure. And I do feel like I don't think that there's much chance that we will go back to exactly how it was.
Well, and there's other accelerations I think we're seeing as well, which are going to be, I mean, working in this, well, I used to work in biotech. Now there's this whole data thing. And I mean, you can really see that these two areas are now rapidly growing together. I mean, lots of these vaccines that have been created, they're essentially biological programs, right? Where somebody has just basically figured out, here's a smart way to tell your cell to, on its surface, put something that looks like a virus, so your immune system learns, you know, to attack that.
Yep.
But there's a lot of lab work in there, but it's also part programming, right? So how do I need to design a genetic code to do certain things?
Yeah.
And this has been, I mean, so some of the clients that we're working with are in this space, and they were really doing well. But through this whole corona thing, I think that's also something that has been accelerated, this whole aspect of biological programming and figuring out what you can do with genetic code. Yeah. And not just reading it, but actually writing it and putting it back into the system. I think that's also going to be something where we're all going to be amazed over the next years what has happened. And it's probably without COVID, I think it would have happened anyways, but it would have taken a few years longer. And now with the vaccines, we're really seeing how well that works. I'm really, amazed and scared what's going to happen with biological programming over the next
me too.
few years.
CRISPR scares me to death. I mean, maybe because I don't understand it well enough, but I think I understand it well enough that I'm scared to death. But anyway, but it is, it is interesting. I think really interesting to think about what are the other things that are being accelerated by this. And so clearly e-commerce, clearly biotech with, you know, and I mean, I'm all in, Sebastian. I got my first Pfizer, you know.
Oh, you did? Jab.
Yeah, I got it. It'll be,
I'm so jealous. I so wanted.
I mean, you know, and I mean, I guess it's, I'm hoping that it's all
it's
safe.
A piece of German engineering, right? I mean, it's invented by BioNTech. This, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, yep. So, you know, so it's coursing through my veins right now. So we'll see.
Reprogramming your cells.
Exactly, right? Yes.
Well, it actually doesn't reprogram, but yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it is interesting, right? Because I think one of the things that we're, let's talk about this for a second, okay? It's a little bit dangerous territory and I don't want to offend people, but let me start by saying that I think it's kind of weird that people who think that Bill Gates is trying to put chips into their body through a vaccine would storm the Capitol, do things that were tremendously illegal with their phones on, with their location reporting on, with their cameras on, right? Like, I mean, Bill Gates doesn't need to put chips in us. We carry him around all the time, right? We're never going to put this down. I'm going to have this right by me all the time.
Isn't that, though, like the legacy of Steve Jobs and not Bill Gates? And maybe he's jealous, you know?
Yeah, maybe so, right? Yeah, right. Bill wants, he's like, well, they've got, yeah.
We don't have Windows mobile operating systems anymore, I guess.
Yeah, he's going to put that right into people because I'm jealous. Well, you know, but I feel like we, you know, so I don't think it's a secret that I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. I think that he is a character study and just what doesn't work about like anything good about leadership. He's the opposite. So forget policy, forget political parties. I don't like either political party. I'm so disgusted with both of them. And I think Donald Trump was just something completely on another level of just what doesn't work when it comes to leadership. So that's how I feel. And I think that the United States absolutely blew our response. We had such a great team and we had plans and we could have done so much better. And then I look at Germany and Europe and I'm like, well, wait a minute, you know, is it just impossible for humans to do this well? You know, like how in the world could we have botched it so badly and yet Europe botched it too? And then I kind of think, okay, I think that there was some, you know, I think in the initial days, I don't think we got the straight deal about what was going on. And then the WHO, I think, really botched their messaging. And then the CDC ultra botched their messaging, maybe with political interference. But, and then even most recently, Johnson & Johnson, because they only talked about their vaccine like they were scientists talking to scientists, kind of botched the launch of their vaccine. You know, like it got the way that they talked about it made it look like it wasn't as effective as I think it actually really is. And so what is up?
Yeah, well, I think here in Europe, everybody just became too confident, right? So I think we did some good steps a year ago when the whole thing started. And then everybody, I think that the mutual or the collective feeling was basically, okay, so, you know, we're doing good. And what no one realized is that basically you don't get extra credit for having done it well in the past with these sorts of things, right? It's like, you know, you mess it up, you have your second wave. It doesn't matter that you got an, you know, B minus or whatever on your first wave. No, that's not how these sort of things work. And I think the whole topic of messaging and how to deliver a message well, you know, you could see so many things going right, but also so many things going wrong in this pandemic. Yeah, I was very open to my team, for example, and they told me afterwards what they had thought when I said it. I told them in May we're probably not going to open up offices this year. So May of last year, and they told me later that when I told them that, they were all thinking, okay, you know, you know, you're a boss, but he's gone slightly crazy, maybe in his home office or something like that. But this is everybody knew we had the data, right? So everybody knew there's going to be a second wave. It's going to come in winter. It's going to be worse than this. It just played out exactly as scientists or people who study this sort of thing told us it would. And then all of that stuff got lost in messaging. Nobody wanted to say it or say the bad thing. And this is what I find so annoying. And to be honest, also, everybody who's dealing with these kind of viruses, they said they're going to there's going to be mutations. Well, look, we have mutations. Surprise,
When you give a thing millions and millions and millions and millions of opportunities to mutate, it's going to. It can't help it.
Evolution kind of works that way.
Yes. You know? So. Yeah. And the more chances, the more people it infects, the more chances it gets, right? So that was yet another reason to, slow the spread and limit, right? Yeah.
But I think, then, once I got the feedback from my team, you know, what they thought at the time, of course, they didn't tell me at the time. They only told
right,
me.
That's
how that
Don't
works.
Don't tell me he's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. I noticed. So I started when the team was very small, and I noticed that, like, once your team is above 10 people, they don't tell you stuff anymore. That seems to be also some biological human thing, right?
It's the Jesus thing. I mean, it's why there were 12 disciples, because anymore and it gets wildly political. And even with 12, it got pretty political pretty fast.
You know? Oh, I have these images in my mind. Well, should we tell Jesus that? You know?
Right. Yeah, no, don't tell Jesus. That's crazy. No. Yeah.
I think this, you know, all these scientists, and it's really good that we, I think, as a whole, started listening more to scientists. I think that's also one of the good things that came out of this pandemic. That is like, yeah, this makes sense. And also a bit more understanding for this whole how science works thing. You know, that basically you can't, actually changing your message is a good thing if you do it based on facts. And it's not like this whole, oh, suddenly he's saying another thing. Well, or she, for that matter. Yeah. Of course they are, because, you know, the facts, we've come across new facts and it changed. Yeah. I really like that, you know, that more and more people are realizing. And also it's useful for me as a data scientist, because people always say, well, I come in with the data, the facts, the statistics. I got to know what's happening. And I always have to say, well, like the scientist, based on the data we have, we think it's that. But if we get new data, it could also be this. And then they're like, well, is it this or that? And I say, well, currently it's this. And this kind of messaging has become more palatable to people. And that makes my job a lot easier, I have to say.
Yeah, that's good. I tell people all the time, you can be right.
Yeah.
Like these executives and things. And like, you know, I'm like, you can be right or you can be happy. And I think in science, it's the same thing, right? You can be right and cling to what you said yesterday and fight against the changing understanding that is coming out of your data, or you can be happy and say, look, we thought this yesterday based on the new data, we've changed our minds and we're now, what it really looks like is this, and you can be happy, right?
Yeah. Or you can also just, you know, do you really, I think also this notion of, you know, you having to stand there and say, this is what it is. I don't think that's actually necessary. I think it's quite useful also, you know, because we're on the, you know, talking like a leader podcast. I think as a leader, you can point that out. You can basically say, look, it could be this way or that way based on what we know. Here's what the facts are.
Yeah.
We're going to go with option A today. And if new facts come, or better even, you know, if such and such facts come along, I'm going to switch my mind to option B.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how it's going to be. And come on, we're working with grown-up people. Why can't we communicate to grown-up people like grown-ups? I never get that, you know?
That was the big mistake, I think, on a lot of fronts, was that there
people are not going to understand this. And they said, no, and they are. Just explain it, please. Sorry.
You know, people can hear anything. People can be with things much better than we want to give them credit for.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a massive mistake as a leader. It's like what Benjamin Zander says in his talk. You know, he says a leader must believe in the people he's leading. Imagine if Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, but I'm not sure you're up to it.
Yeah, I love that.
That's not going to work. You know?
Yeah. And belief and also, you know, thinking or believing that people can handle it. Yeah, it's not your job as a leader to sort of figure out what they can handle and then give a sort of, dumbed down or simplified version of it. No, put it out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we just saw that did not work, right? Trying not to panic people and not telling people the truth and stuff. Then no one trusts you at all about anything. And you just get all kinds of wacky stuff.
Well, and we're still going to see some of the consequences, because what at least what we're seeing in Europe right now is people are tired because they've been told every 4 weeks, oh, it's just going to be another 4 weeks.
I think
it's actually one-on-one crisis communication. Tell them in the beginning, this is going to take really long and it's going to be really, really, really freaking hard.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
not the best messaging, but then at least everybody knows what's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is Tony Hsieh, you know, that
of
was
Zappos.
That was his. I'm very sad that we lost him so early, but yeah. I remember a long time ago, because I work with these big corporations, right? And one of my core tenets is authenticity. And I remember wondering if maybe there was a place for, you know, I don't know, kind of not exactly being authentic when you're this big corporation and there's all this stuff at stake, right? And I was kind of working through that in my own mind. Could I go in good conscience and just say, you must always be authentic? And then I heard Tony Hsieh say, with, you know, social media and with the internet, with everything that's going on, transparency is happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I was like, oh, okay. That, you know, and I believe that. I agree with that. And here's the thing that I would tack on. Transparency is happening. And it's way better when you do it than when it happens to you.
Oh, yes. For sure.
And I think that's the fundamental bottom line about it all, right?
But that's also, I think it comes, you know, there's so much misunderstanding about what authenticity is and means and what it's not. I mean, it doesn't mean, you know, tell everything, because that's also, I think, how it's often misunderstood. But I always basically say, okay, let's make the assumptions all things are going to become transparent in the end.
And yes,
because most likely they do. Will. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if they do, we still got to be able to stand here and say, this is why we did it that way. You know, once you basically say, I'm going to hide facts to somehow get my decision through, that's when you're on the wrong path. And I think that's sort of, for me, authenticity. You know, I can still basically make unpopular conclusions about stuff, you know, but don't, you know, assume that or don't do something where once facts come to light, you're going to look stupid, because facts do come to light. That's just how the world runs these days.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And authentic doesn't mean doing whatever you freaking feel like in the moment, like a 4-year-old, you know. It there's a thought.
Although
out.
It does feel refreshing, you know, but yes.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. It can be fun, but not always the best business approach. So Sebastian, tell me, you did do some other TED Talks. Let's mention those really quick.
So after the whole analyzing the TED Talks thing, you know, I really got into the habit. So there's a couple of others that I did where, for example, I tried to crowdsource a 6-word summary of the entire TED conference using Amazon Web Services. That was fun.
Yeah, that's cool. Do you remember what the 6 words ended up being? Do you still remember?
I think it was... Well, actually, should I reveal that? Because then there are people.
Oh, yeah, no, that's
it. Takes 6 minutes. It takes 6 minutes to watch the talk. Spoiler alert!
Yeah, I did not want to spoil that. You're right. I asked the question, and now you can go find out yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. Let's get people enticed here. And
yes, very good catch.
And then after that, the one I did on the main stage of TED it was inspired by this whole choose your own adventure kind of books. And so I let people choose their own TED Talks. And then they had like these color cards, green and red, and they could at some points vote where it's going to go.
and it was fun. I mean, that was an analog vote, right?
That was a totally analog vote. And it also gave me the liberty to completely decide which way. I didn't cheat though. There was no cheating, but you know, if it was like 50-50, I could sort of say, okay, we're going to go with
you could lean
option A or B.
That's funny.
and then that was it. Right. And so basically I took a break from TED Talks. I got asked to do one more, which actually they put on TED.com. Much closer to the work I do now. So about decision making and the role that data plays in decision making, and then I got my first child, and now it's done. Yeah. Don't have the time. Don't have the 10 hours per minute that it needs to prepare a talk like that. Right.
So what would you say Tell, because I think people often wonder, right? What's it like to have spoken at TED, and what's the impact it had on you, and what I mean, and you know, okay, so you know, I got to meet you because of that. I mean, you know, so I get that there are a lot of things, but what are some of the maybe unexpected, I don't know, maybe personal inside journeys that you got out of all that experience on the TED stage and crafting those things? Like, what are some things you could share with people that just might make a difference for them, whether they ever talk at TED or not, you know?
But I think ultimately it comes down for me mostly to the people I met. So I think the picture that people have in mind is like, okay, you go on this TED stage and you give this great talk, and then these famous people will come up to you and say, you know, I want to do something with you. Can you, you know, yeah, whatever. And
Bill Gates is like, listen, we were thinking of opening a place in Buffalo.
Can you found a company? You know, yeah. It's so funny. My brother, when I came back from TED, he was like, did you shake the hands of Bill Gates? And I was like, no, yeah. I mean, I peed next to Richard Branson. That's basically as far as I got, to this.
Which is, well, that's, you know, that's something.
yeah, probably. I remember the experience more than he does, probably. But it's all of these little connections that you make, you know, and there's real friendships that come out of this, you know. I mean, 10 years after we're talking here, there's a good friend in Boston that I met there. And the reason for working in Boston was because from TED, somebody introduced me to somebody else and said, oh, I know this guy, you know, founding a biotech company. Don't you want to join there? And networking with these like-minded people, not networking, which is, I think, one of the misconceptions, you know, with the famous people or the rich people or whatever. Yeah. That's not what it's about. It's about this genuine connection thing. And I think that's what I got out of that. The whole speaking thing, I have to say, like on this main stage, that's just insane. You know, it's almost like a traumatic experience in some way, because you know who's sitting there, and it's all so amped up, and it's just you can do it, but I think it's more like, okay, you know, some people have bungee jumping. Do it for the ride, do it for the thrill. But there's this other cool stuff you can have on your bucket list as well, and you're going to be a very happy person if you do that instead.
Yeah. That's right. That's so funny. That's awesome. I mean, you know, it really is that collection of people that you got to speak to from the TED main stage that was there in person, not wearing masks, by the way. you know, that, I mean, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, like all kinds of.
I still remember that one moment I looked around and was like, oh, the Nobel Prize winner. Oh, well, he's finding my joke funny. Well, that's good. You know, but as I said, you know, it's hilarious. It's a thrill, right? And that's fine. And I wouldn't want to have missed it. And it's sort of a peak experience kind of thing. But the change, and I have to say also, it changed my life, but not in the way you would think. Changed my life that I met great people that I got to hang out with, and that I got to do cool projects with afterwards. And I wouldn't want to miss that for the world. If I had to give up one of these two things, like, you know, the thrill of speaking in front of all these famous people, nice, but the friendships, no way I'm going to ever, you know, want to trade that in. That's the part.
Well, and you know, I totally agree with you that it changed my life too, and not in some way that I think is expected, right? It's not somebody walked up to me after I was on stage and, like, you know, invested in my company or something. but it does come down to those relationships. And I think it's one of the things that maybe I misunderstood when I was younger a little bit, is what real meaningful networking sounds like. Mm-hmm. It's not just collecting business cards so that you've got nodes in your pocket to connect to now, right? Yeah. It's like actually taking the time to get to know someone and to talk to them and find out what matters to them and find places where your interests overlap and maybe support them in some way that's unexpected and send them a, you know, like, I don't know, send them a postcard or, I mean, who knows, right? Yeah. But it's those very human connected things that end up being the real gift, I think, from.
And I mean, that's how we met, right? I mean, that's basically we threw ourselves into this random place, and all we knew about each other was not, you know, it wasn't an industry conference. It wasn't. We're just like, okay, we like cool ideas. Well, you like cool ideas. I like cool ideas. Yeah. Well, let's find something out about each other and take it from there. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yep. Well, you know, I mean, what a great approach to just bring to life, right?
Yeah.
Like, here we are together. We both are here for some reason or another. Let's find out, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even have to be Ted. It could be the grocery store, right? But if that's the attitude you go in with, I think it could make a difference.
Yeah, totally. And of course, it helps, you know, if you know that the other person likes the same kind of talks that you do.
That does help. That really does help. That's for sure. That's for sure. So Sebastian, is there anything that you would want to share with us before we wrap it up, like about leadership, about communication? Did you ever have, I don't know, a great leader that you got a story about, or somebody you want to give a shout out to, or
Well, I've had many, many great leaders that I got to work with or work for. So, but I think, you know, the one theme that's common through everything, like the TED Talks, but also good leaders and how I also want to approach leadership, I think it's this word of contribution. So you think of yourself as a contributor. You know, as giving a TED Talk is not about you selling your idea. It's about contributing something that the audience will like. Leadership is like, you know, you're contributing to the team, you're contributing to the company. And I think if we just thought about more like contribution, that's going to fix a lot of things and make everybody happy, right? And that's what also I think all of the leaders that I had the pleasure of working with, they were always thinking about their contribution and, you know, enabling you to contribute as well.
Yeah.
And that's just beautiful, I think. And that's how leadership also should be.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's absolutely perfect. And I think that's a great place for us to leave it. And what I will say is, thank you for your contribution to me. You know, your willingness to spend all that time taking those pictures and printing stuff out, cutting it out and stretching the yarn between the pins and thinking about it and making it funny, you know, you know, I don't mean to put you on the hot spot. I'm really grateful to you, but I do want to say like that, the fact that you thought about that and did something that was so funny and so engaging and so creative, you brought a whole group of people together that are friends of mine now. And there were other reasons that we all coalesced, but your speech contributed to that. And it gave us something that we could all talk about and laugh about together and jumping off points into all the other things that we did. And I think that if people think about their leadership and they think about the talk they're going to give, or they talk about that personal story they could share in that way, you know, that talk was a gift.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And also thank you for teaching me to just say thank you. This is one of the things I learned from you.
Well, you are welcome and good job. So, Sebastian, I hope that you'll come back and join us again sometime. I do really appreciate the chance to catch up. I'm just really happy for you and your family and
yeah, we both have families now. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, it's so wild. It's so wild. So we'll have to get our boys together here soon.
We will. We will.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so now I didn't say it earlier, and I usually say it earlier. We'll put it in the show notes. But if you want to connect with Sebastian, I believe it's linkedin.com/in/Wernicke. Is that right?
Yes. And otherwise, you can just do the TED Talk Googling thing or something like that. I'm findable. I am findable.
Yes, you are. So, but his last name is Wernicke, Wernicke.
Yes.
So, and I highly recommend that you go watch his TED Talks and that you think about, you know, how much something can contribute, you know, over time, just because you took the time to think about it and make it well done and then offer it out to the world. So
thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
You're super welcome. It's great to have you. And, I, I wish you a wonderful spring, and here's to a great summer. And I'm hoping that, you know, we'll be able to all be getting together with our friends and loved ones here in person.
Absolutely. Yes, this too will pass. And then we can have fun times again. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, take care. Thanks for joining us.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.